Thank you, Your Honor. For the record, my name is Barry Willoughby. I represent the appellant, Alan Blyce. Mr. Blyce is with me in the courtroom today. My associate, Lauren Moak, is also seated with me at the counsel table who assisted on the case. What I'd like to address this morning, if I may, is the court's finding that the defendants were liable for intentional interference with prospective business relations. I think there's a serious inconsistency in the court's ruling when the court had previously found that the defendants were not liable for intentional interference with contractual relations. In other words, it found that the Pfizer, the party with whom the plaintiffs had contracted, had in fact lawfully terminated that contract, the 2003 contract, for legitimate business reasons. The court then went on to find, however, that based on the very same contract, defendants were liable to plaintiffs for intentional interference with prospective business relations.
Right. Is your argument that once having determined that there was no tortious interference with contractual relations, that as a matter of law there could be no tortious interference with prospective business relationships?
No, Your Honor. Our position is that it could not be intentional interference with prospective business relationships based on the very same contract that the court had already found had not been had been lawfully terminated. So in other words, if the court had found that there was some other prospective business relationship other than the 2003 contract that the defendants had interfered with, I think that could be squared.
You're saying that one proposition doesn't follow from the other as a matter of law.
Yes.
And yet you're also saying that the one proposition does follow from the other as a matter of fact?
No, I'm saying as a matter of law on these facts, Your Honor, because here's
okay, why?
Okay, here's what I'm saying. I could see if the court had found that for some reason there was another prospective business relationship other than the existing contract that had been interfered with, that could be something the court may logically have made a ruling on. In this case, the court found that, in fact, the 2003 contract had been lawfully terminated, then went on to find that there had been no interference with contract, but then went on to find that based on the very same 2003 contract, there had been intentional interference with prospective business relations. And what I'm saying is one of the elements of intentional interference with prospective business relations is that there be a reasonable probability of that ongoing business relationship. It's inconsistent for the court to have found that the party, Pfizer, lawfully terminated the agreement and
well,
then turn around
I mean,
and say...
You're just making the same argument but calling it a factual argument, are you not?
I don't believe it's a factual argument, Your Honor. What I'm saying is that the relationship here, you could not have a reasonable probability of continuing a business relationship that the court had already found, in fact, had been lawfully terminated.
Well, perhaps I'm confused about the facts here, but I thought that at the same time that Pfizer, within its rights, terminated its agreement, that the other parties were dealing with Pfizer at a much lower price, which it seems if you know what your competitor's price is and you drop your price well below that, you're pretty likely to win some contracts that way. But if you're doing it tortiously, then you are interfering with prospective relations, aren't you?
I don't believe so, Your Honor, on these facts, because what happened was the court found that on its damage award that the damages were based on the loss of the 2003 contract that it found had been lawfully terminated and actually replaced by a separate agreement between the plaintiffs and Pfizer. So if the court found that there was a separate prospective business relationship that the defendants had interfered with and based an award on that, I think that would be one thing. Here it said you were not liable for interference with the existing contract, yet it turned around under the alternative theory of prospective business relations and found that the defendants were liable for that and awarded damages based on the loss of the contract and not some other prospective business relationship. So our argument essentially is that you can't have a reasonable probability of continuing a business relationship that the other party has already, in fact, terminated. Those two things are fundamentally inconsistent.
But wasn't the termination of the original contract directly tied to your client's conduct?
No, Your Honor. The court found, the Chancery Court found specifically that the Pfizer had the lawful right to terminate the contract did not breach.
Right, and Pfizer was entitled to say, we're through.
Yes.
That doesn't mean that Pfizer would have done that if Pfizer didn't have alternatives that your clients were providing.
Well, Your Honor, the court actually found at page 82 of the opinion that Pfizer was unlikely to continue with the contract because it was very unhappy with it from the beginning, including price considerations, business ethics considerations by the plaintiffs, and other factors. So at page 82 of the opinion, it found, in, as a matter of fact.
Yeah, but the court also found that although Pfizer was, trying to, move into lower price suppliers, there was one category of suppliers that was exempted from that, and Beard Research and its affiliate were part of it. And even after the contract was terminated or around that time, Beard was being lauded for the quality of its product.
And that's true, Your Honor, and that there were, there was a finding by the court that Beard was a good supplier of chemical compounds to Pfizer and that Pfizer was willing to keep doing business with them. But that's not the same as saying that there wasn't a general movement to move this business offshore, that plaintiffs were exempted from that.
What you're saying is that the court could not have reasonably or properly have found that once this contract was terminated that there would have been any further relationships at all or any expectation thereof.
On that contract.
Right?
Yes,
on that contract. As a factual matter.
As a legal matter, I believe, Your Honor, because I think the court found as a matter of law that the contract was lawfully terminated.
Then the answer to the first question I asked you has to be yes. You're saying as a legal matter, if there could not be an interference with the contractual relationship because of an unqualified right to terminate, then it follows perforce that there could not be an interference, a tortious interference with prospective relations, at least in prospective business relations.
Yes, with respect to that contract. I think that has to be the law because you could not have a reasonable probability of continuing a relationship that had been lawfully terminated.
Now, in that, you catch that as a legal argument, but if it's a factual proposition, then the analysis is different, isn't it?
Certainly the standard of review is different. I do couch it as a legal argument, I think, because when you look at the two torts, when you have a finding that the contractor was, in fact, lawfully terminated, I don't think as a matter of law you can say there was a reasonable probability that that very same contract could be continued. And I guess where, to me, the proof of the pudding is that when the court went on to award damages, it did not find a loss of some other relationship and award damages on that. It awarded damages on the loss of the contract.
Mr. Willoughby, as a courtesy to you, I stopped the clock with your 1 minute left.
Okay.
Do you want to continue to use your 1 minute now, or would you like to reserve it?
Unless there's a question the court would like me to address now, I would reserve it.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. Appreciate that.
John Elzaphan for Smith, Cates, and ASG. The reason why I only put 1 minute for opening was not out of disrespect for the process, but because there's seven issues involving my client. I don't know which one the court wants to address. I don't want to choose the wrong one by accident, boy, Your Honors. So if you have questions, I'm certainly here ready to answer them and recognizing it will probably eat into my rebuttal time, and I'm okay with that. But I read over my briefs many times. I don't have anything to add to what's in the briefs. I'm not trying to be disrespectful of the court or the process. Just trying to be efficient at the time I'm allotted with two other defendants and what the court wants to address as to Cates, Smith, and ASG. If the court has no questions, then I will reserve for rebuttal. Again, I'm not being disrespectful. I'm trying to be efficient here.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Elizabeth Sloan of Blank Rome on behalf of Appellant ASCI. With me in the courtroom is Mr. Capone, a partner in my office, and Mr. Polonia of ASCI. As the Court is well aware, I only have a short amount of time, so I'd like to just point out a few brief points that I believe that require reversal of both the merits and the spoliation opinion. First, the trial court improperly conflates ASG's conduct to ASCI. the merits opinion and the spoliation opinion treat these two entities as one without any type of analysis, either under an agency theory or a veil-piercing theory, and that is completely improper as it is disregarding the corporate form. Second, without any imputation theory allowed, there is no facts that relate to ASDI that you could find ASDI liable under any of the claims in this lawsuit.
Let's back up for a minute. ASDI, the court did say that if only on a theory of respondeat superior, ASDI could be held liable for the acts, the wrongful acts of its two human principals, who would have been Cates and I forgot the name of the gentleman who is not a party, but who is the original owner and CEO of ASD.
Your Honor, I would say that first, as it relates,
would you agree?
I would
that
not
the court that the court held that.
No, I would not. Although that there was a
court
slight
didn't hold that ASD could be held liable on a theory of respondeat superior. I think it's in the opinion.
I believe that it was mentioned, but I don't think that it was an actual finding. Moreover, I think that if it were a specific finding, that it was a misapplication of the law. First of all, there was not a specific analysis as it relates to Mr. Cates for a theory of imputation. It might have been merely suggested.
Not have been an analysis, but Cates and his cohort, Peroni, is that his name?
Mr. Peroni.
Yes. Were the managers, the owners, and the sole employees, or at least the sole key employees. They were, as far as the opinion finds, acting not in their own personal self-interest, but were acting for the benefit of their employer, ASD. Why wouldn't that be sufficient for respondeat superior analysis?
Well, as it relates to Mr. Peroni's conduct, there was no analysis of how Mr. Peroni was, how Mr. Peroni's conduct was imputed to ASDI. Second of all, Mr. Peroni was never a named defendant in the case. Therefore,
It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. It was held that he was knee deep in the same wrongdoing as Mr. Cates. Correct. So why should ASDI get a pass because one of the key employees was not sued?
Because here at this point we would be speculating because there's just an utter lack of factual findings and analysis as it relates to Mr. Peroni. There was just no.
Okay. Well, if we were to disagree with you and find that the court did hold what I suggest it held and that it was correct in so holding, would that change your argument as far as ASG is concerned?
No, not as far as ASG's conduct is concerned, because then with ASG's conduct, there would have to be an analysis of under either an agency theory or a veil-piercing theory, neither of which
Why?
Is actually mentioned in.
What about the fact that ASG and ASD were owned by the same people, although there were a couple of others that were also involved in the ownership of ASG? And that ASG was formed basically by ASD and its principals as part of an overall scheme to wrongfully take business away from Beard. In other words, why doesn't a conspiracy theory properly bring in ASG? Whether ASG is a subsidiary or whether you pierce the corporate veil.
First, I would say, Your Honor, that there was no factual analysis of that to hold that ASG was an affiliate or a subsidiary of ASDI. Second of all, if you look at the cases cited in our brief and even in the merits opinion, for example, Miles is a completely inopposite case as it relates to here. That was a wholly owned subsidiary. This is not. ASDI and ASG are not owned by the same people. ASDI does not own any stock in ASG. There's no common board. All ASDI did was guarantee a loan to ASG as a startup loan. It was an arm's length transaction. And ASDI did provide some payroll services, but that was under an independent contract to ASG. So therefore, I would say that there is no way that we can hold that you can hold that ASDI and ASG are affiliated. Moreover,
so your legal point is that in order to properly bring in ASG into the liability umbrella, ASG had to have been either a subsidiary or the court should have pierced the corporate veil and properly ignored the separate legal existence of ASG?
Absolutely. There was no finding under, there was no analysis whatsoever, actually, in either the merits opinion or the spoliation opinion that tied these two corporations together. And that just is completely improper under Delaware law because it's basically disregarding corporate form.
Would you like to continue or would you like to reserve your remaining time?
Thank you, Your Honor. I'll go ahead and reserve the remaining time for rebuttal unless there's additional questions. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Carl Hill. I'm here on behalf of the appellees, CB Research and Beard Research. Your Honors, I've lived this case for about 5 years. It seems like an eternity, but more than 5 years. And so did Vice Chancellor Parsons. This was a case, in my experience, I've never had this before, where almost 20 times we were before the Vice Chancellor on substantive issues. The Vice Chancellor also presided over a companion case that was brought by Dr. Cates against Beard Research.
Mr. Hill, we've read both opinions. We understand what the history was. We have a limited time to address the issues.
Understood. I'd like to move on just briefly on the standard of review, and I think, Justice Jacobs, you were probing about that with counsel for the balance. And I looked at all the cases, the seminal cases, Levitt versus Bovier, and that case talks about the deference that's provided to a trial court, especially in this case, who has the unique opportunity to gauge the facts, credibility of the witnesses, and all of the evidence. This is a 5-day trial. The deference is that if the Vice Chancellor provided a logical and deductive reasoning process, and Your Honors are fully aware of this, but I looked at it very carefully, then the factual findings and findings relating to creating a remedy and damages are entitled to deference. What you're hearing, I believe, from the appellants is that the trial court did not link every one of his deductions or conclusions in the opinion to a piece of direct evidence that would have either been an exhibit or a witness, et cetera, et cetera. They're missing the point. It's called an opinion for a reason, and Vice Chancellor Parsons, in 88 pages, carefully and methodically went through a complicated and very factual intensive case. The issues on appeal are factual, and I've cited those cases.
Wait a second. I agree that at least some of the issues may be factual, but the argument we just heard was that there was no factual finding of piercing the corporate veil for whatever reasons would be permissible to pierce the corporate veil. There was no relationship between the two companies as parent and subsidiary. And as a result, notwithstanding the facts that the trial court found to exist, the law does not support a finding that ASDI is liable. What's your answer to that?
Thank you, Your Honor. Let me address that. The what the Vice Chancellor found on these tort claims is that ASDI, in its own right and stead, was directly liable. The Miles versus Cookson case, which involved a parent and subsidiary, it didn't go into the issue of veil piercing or agency because, by virtue of the funding by the parent corporation, Cookson America, the court and the interrelationship between the companies, the fact that there was confidential material shared between the companies, very similar to the facts of this case. In that case, the parent corporation was found directly liable. That's what we're talking about here. And the Vice Chancellor...
So what is it that ASDI did directly that made it liable?
Many, many things, Your Honor. The one thing that I'd like to tell you about, because this is all in the briefs and there's lots of evidence, but I had what I called a Perry Mason moment, and that was a witness who was a former employee of ASDI, a shareholder of ASDI, Wayne Whitaker, who I subpoenaed and he testified at trial very credibly that the idea to bury CB, to take all of its business, to have the Pfizer contract canceled, for Blize to use his contacts at Pfizer and his access at Pfizer that he still had to take down CB. That, Your Honor, was probably the most compelling and hair-raising testimony that anyone heard in the courtroom that week. That's one thing. There are other things. There are issues associated with ASDI itself, and in my appendix, it's very lengthy, and I apologize for that. In that appendix, you will see that ASDI, for instance, PX410, which is B280-281, is an analytical report prepared by ASDI that touts the CB analytical information that they had at ASDI. That is an ASDI document. Furthermore, ASDI, Your Honors, bought large quantities, this is kilogram quantities, over kilogram quantities of the key core compounds of CB, which became a part of the CB tree-based catalog system and experiment.
The Magnificent Seven.
The Magnificent Seven, correct, Your Honor. And
well, but wait a second, just so that I'm clear about this. ASG is the newly formed company that was directly competing, if you will. Am I right?
For most of the time, yes.
Okay.
And I can tell you why I qualified my answer if you want.
Let's wait a second.
Okay.
And I understand that ASDI provided ASG with funding, setting up labs, other buying chemicals, whatever. That being said, it is possible that ASDI thought it was just funding a new business that seemed like a potentially successful business. What do we have that shows that ASDI knew that ASG was committing torts, was stealing trade secrets and so forth?
Maybe I can highlight maybe the top two that float to my mind
first.
Okay.
Well, doesn't your position to have to be that the knowledge of the two key employees and managers of ASD is attributed to ASD?
Absolutely. And I think Your Honor mentioned Cates and Poloni. It was actually Mr. Blize and Poloni, which wore the ASDI hats. They were respectively the chief operating officer and the CEO.
I stand corrected.
Okay. But that's Defendant Blize and and Poloni, who was the CEO and chairman of the board of ASDI at that time. And, Your Honor, back to your question, but the top two that come to my mind are that Mr. Blize and Mr. Poloni sought Dr. Cates out. They had, this is Mr. Blize wearing an ASDI hat, in the time frame of beginning in February of 2003, when magically Dr. Cates stopped submitting his cell phone bills to Beard Research for reimbursement, you start to have numerous phone calls. This is all in the record, 40, 50 phone calls. You have 18 to 20 meetings at ASDI between Ron Poloni and Alan Blize and Dr. Cates. You have, Your Honor, Dr. Cates identifying himself as a consultant of ASDI in a presentation he gave to a university, where he also disclosed confidential information about CB and the catalog of CB. You have as well the negotiation and requirement that Dr. Cates sign a mutual nondisclosure agreement, which he signed, according to his testimony in the record, in June of 2003, wherein this is with ASDI, not with ASG, with ASDI, wherein it is specifically contemplated that Dr. Cates would provide confidential information in respect to a potential business opportunity. And you have the secret meetings. These are the meetings that Mr. Whitaker, the eyewitness, the Perry Mason witness, that overheard all about a scheme. Your Honor, Vice Chancellor Parsons, in his opinion, mentioned the word scheme or plot 6 times total. He talked about stealing, talked about taking away, he talked about intent to cancel, he talked about trying to bury my clients. And, Your Honor, that's what this case was all about. Vice Chancellor Parsons understood it, and the judgment is a reflection of his getting this case. You can't look at these pieces of evidence one by one like pieces of a thousand-piece puzzle, like the defendants like to try to say, and one by one say, well, that's not wrongful, that's not wrongful. You put it all together, and I got the key pieces of the puzzle from a former employee and shareholder of ASDI, Wayne Whitaker. He allowed me to see the picture of the puzzle, the total picture, and he allowed Vice Chancellor Parsons to see that picture.
Mr. Hill,
yes, Your Honor.
Although it wasn't raised in the opening arguments, it is there is in the briefs a contention that the tortious interference with prospective business relations claim is preempted by the Delaware Uniform Trade Secrets Act. Can you address that?
Absolutely, Your Honor. The preemption requires, and there's no dispute, I don't think, about any of the legal standards that apply here, and that's, I think, why I said before that this is a factual case. But the standard is that the same facts that you would need to prove a trade secrets claim are the same identical facts you would need to prove the tort of tortious interference, meaning, as the courts have said, that the both claims are grounded in the same facts. That's not the case here as it relates to tortious interference. And
well, some of the facts that are required, let me say it differently, isn't it the case that all of the facts that would prove intentional interference with prospective relations would go to proving the misappropriation of trade secrets?
No, not necessarily, Your Honor. And the key facts to distinguish those claims are the facts relating to the meeting that occurred, and this is on the tortious interference claim only right now, Your Honor. And on that tortious interference claim, you recall, and I said it this way, and pardon my colloquialism, the fix was in here. And what happened in connection with the contacts that that Mr. Blize used at Pfizer while he still wore a badge for Pfizer and worked for ASDI, and the presence of testimony and evidence that there were meetings with Mike Clark and proposals with Mike Clark at Pfizer, and these are facts that are all tethered completely to the record, that ASG needed a FTE contract, a contract with Pfizer as a foundation of the business. That's the motive.
Well, I'm trying to get you to address a legal point.
I'm sorry.
And the question I asked is, I mean, I think we accept that the totality of the facts that would be needed to prove a misappropriation of a trade secret may be broader than the universe of facts needed to prove an intentional interference, tortious interference with business relations. However, the second category of facts could all be probative of the first set, that is, of misappropriation of a trade secret. Is that right or not?
I'd say yes, Your Honor.
Yes, what?
That is right. Those facts could be relevant to the claim of a misappropriation of trade secrets. But the key to the analysis.
Why doesn't preemption flow from that concession?
Because the claims, the facts to prove the claims, do not match.
They're not coextensive.
They're not coextensive, exactly. Okay. And there are
then,
there were
then
so
how
many
do
more
we
facts.
Address Judge Robinson's opinion, which suggests at least in one part, which is consistent with your argument, that an intentional tortious interference with business relations would not be preempted by DUTSA. And yet later in the opinion, she suggests that it might be, depending on what the factual record shows.
Right. I think that's the Epitharm case, and I know the case. And that was a case on a motion to dismiss based on the well-pleaded allegations of the complaint.
To the extent that the U.S. District Court suggests that there may be preemption, is that case wrongly decided, or is it?
It's not wrongly decided, Your Honor. At the posture that it was in, it's perfectly acceptable, meaning it was on procedural posture of dealing with a motion to dismiss. Here we have all the proof. You know, the evidence is all in. And I submit to you that Mr. Whitaker's testimony in and of itself proves the tortious interference claim, because that's the testimony where it proved that there was a scheme between Cates, Blize, and Mr. Poloni on behalf of ASDI to steal away the Pfizer contract. That's a specific reference to the Pfizer contract. And, Your Honor, if I might, I want to address Mr. Willoughby's argument on behalf of Mr. Blize relating to the tortious interference of prospective relations and what he calls the illogical disconnection of that claim. And this is very simple. And Justice Berger, you pointed to this. And what the Vice Chancellor did on this claim is to say, yes, technically Pfizer had a right pursuant to the express language of the contract between CB and Pfizer to terminate that multi-year contract, based on the departure, which was a fact, of Dr. Cates. But you'll read in the opinion that what Vice Chancellor Parsons found and what we had argued was that by virtue of the tortious conduct of the defendants, and this is all of the defendants, that the tortious conduct of the defendants, mainly Cates, Blize, and Poloni, in this scheme to have Pfizer cancel their contract, for Blize to use his contacts at Pfizer to make it happen, the fact that they signed a contract with Pfizer before they even met with CB.
I'm sorry, is your argument that but for the wrongful conduct of these defendants, that there was a basis for a reasonable expectation on the part of the plaintiffs that there wouldn't have been a contract cancellation, or that even if there was a contract cancellation, there would still be some business flowing? What exactly is the reasonable expectation?
Your Honor, what Vice Chancellor Parsons found was that either, based on the tortious conduct, either Pfizer would have not terminated. And I have to give you a footnote or a reference right there, because these couple facts are important to this analysis. CB, and I put these exhibits into the appendix, CB Research and Beard Research were described as having unmatched productivity by Pfizer. They were called the most productive CRO for Pfizer worldwide. They were described as a synthetic machine by Mr. Blize while he worked for Pfizer and knew all about the Pfizer contract and key man clause. And
I'm asking actually what the court found.
Okay. The court found, Your Honor, that given this stellar reputation that I just went through and the fact that they propose an infinitely credible and qualified replacement of Dr. Ving Li, that the fix, what they did, the scheme, made Pfizer either, or would have either made Pfizer not terminate the contract, my English is poor there, I'm sorry, not terminate the contract, or would have given another relationship to the plaintiffs on much more favorable terms.
Than the modified contract.
And in the modified contract, you recall, the Pfizer folks, in the meeting of April 14th, after the meeting at ASDI on April 13th, the day after in Groton, Connecticut, told CB, we are dropping you down to zero FTEs. We are chopping completely the $950,000 per quarter for the next 20 months that we're due under the contract. And CB, the fact of the matter is, laid off half their workforce as a result of that. And that's in the testimony of Susan Bayless Powell at trial. And what happened there was the relationship was modified. And I have to correct Mr. Willoughby on one thing. If you look at page 83 of the opinion, what Mr. Willoughby is trying to say is, well, wait a minute, the judge awarded damages on the future stream of payments under the contract, and that doesn't make sense when he found that there was no tortious interference with underscore the contract. And that's a simple answer. The judge at page 83, Vice Chancellor Parsons, says, I am not awarding separate damages for the contract. Those are already subsumed within the valuation of the enterprise loss and the loss of income to the companies. And if I could just briefly talk about the damages. The damages, the court carefully considered both the experts. Both parties essentially agreed that the methodology, meaning the formula to determine what the loss of enterprise value and lost cash flow were consistent. And he found wrongful conduct based on the torts committed. He found proximate causation, and he carefully merged or melded, which case law like Porter says is proper and appropriate and subject to deference, and came up with a number that was supported absolutely in the record.
Well, there were two methods that were used to calculate damages. One was a loss of revenue over a period of time. The other was a loss of profits over a period of time. In both cases, isn't that analysis or both analyses, don't they presuppose that the contract would not have been terminated?
They don't, Your Honor. What they take into consideration is you look at the wrongful conduct. There was no dispute whatsoever that the historical data showed that this company tanked right after Cates left, and that the value, the enterprise value, and the loss of net income, which he accepted Dr. Metrics, blended 15.5%. We didn't appeal it. It was a proper exercise of discretion. That shows what this company would have been worth if torts had not been committed against them.
Yes, and if torts had not been committed, then there most likely would not have been a cancellation or a modification of the contract.
That's true.
My question is, either method that was utilized, that was adopted by the Vice Chancellor, presupposed that full revenue stream and profit stream, that is, based on a non-cancellation, would have continued?
No, it doesn't. It includes the revenue that was received factually, historically, on accounting basis for the years 2004 and 2005. It then projects out what this company should have been worth when it was sold to Adesis in late 2005. So what it presupposes is that this company would have, on a chart, would have gone to a certain level and had a certain value as of the time of the sale of Adesis in 2005.
Thank you, Mr. Hill.
All right, thank you.
Your Honor, I'd like to address the damages issue that was just talked about. I think the evidence or the record in the court's opinion is plain that the court considered damages based on the cancellation of the contract. All the calculations that the court made for its loss of profits, loss of revenue, were based on the concept that the 2003 contract had been canceled. And that's one of our fundamental problems with the court's analysis, is that the court awarded damages based on the cancellation of the contract, having at the same time found that the contract had been lawfully terminated by Pfizer. So that's one of the fundamental issues that I think is an error in the court's reasoning. And it's true that the court said that it's not going to make a separate award based on the ongoing renewals of the contract. Dr. Metrick had testified that he was assuming that the contract with Pfizer would go on forever.
And by the way, I think in vain, in both the opinion of the trial court and in the nine briefs that were filed for Dr. Metrick's first name. Is there a first name?
Andrew Metrick. Yes, apologize, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Willoughby.
Thank you.
Thank you all. Are you going to come back, Mr. Elzafon?
Yes.
Sure.
And I won't even use my 5 minutes.
I think a distinction has to be drawn between the fact that Mike Cates left CBRD and how he left it. We will just assume for the purpose of argument's sake only that it was done in a quote-unquote tortious manner. But he could leave any time he wanted to, and the fact that he left is what caused the Pfizer contract to be canceled. He could have left to go to DeSales University. He could have been hit by a drunk truck driver and been killed. But he had, there were reasons why he wanted to leave.
Nobody claims that he did anything, he committed any wrongdoing by leaving.
And the, I know that. And the mere fact of his leaving, that in of itself, gave Pfizer the right to contract, to cancel the contract, and no other reason. And therefore, all this, and I think that's a key point to understand why the Pfizer contract was, well, modified, canceled, whatever you want to do, and take it from there. But that distinction, I think, is important, and I wish to point that out to the court. On the issue of deference of evidence, if I can go to the Gary Smith damages, I'm just on the deference issue, the court is entitled to deference, but as I cited in my brief, there were aspects of the findings against Dr. Smith on damages which focused on testimony which really wasn't part of the court's opinion below. That's in my brief, and I think that's important to point out on the issue of Smith's damages, which I would suggest were wrongly calculated for that reason. I thank the court for the time.
Thank you all. The court will take this matter. Do you have something else to say?
1 point. Thank you. I just have 1 point to make, that what I think is going on right now with, as it relates to ASCI and as Mr. Hill's argument is pointing out, is that we're trying to put the pieces together, which just reiterates my argument that the trial court's opinions are just completely devoid of facts and legal analysis as it relates to ASCI. Thank you.
The court will take the matter under advisement and take a brief recess.